But also, to round out the sutta, I was going to pull in some other suttas regarding dana, which is generosity, in the context of the path. I mean, the whole practice is, you know, just not dana. It's dana, and then a sila, and then bhavana, which is development. And that's the whole path, okay, in terms of generosity. And finally, to point out the perils of living in an area of abundance. You know, as you know, Bodhinyana Monastery have lots and lots of gift and lots of fame and renown. Anything that happens there, people all over the world knows about it. I was there recently at Dhammagiri, which is a new monastery in Brisbane. And we had this American guy who came from Bhavana Society. And he's very interested in why all these disrobos from Bodhinyana. So people, you know, get around, news gets around about Bodhinyana because I guess Ajahn Brahm travels a lot. And, you know, the monastery itself is, you know, one of the largest monasteries. So it's just one of the perils of living in a monastery that's very well supported and reading some kind of suttas, just kind of cautioning the lay people to exercise some kind of restraint and kind of supporting the monks. But I'll go into that later. Okay, so we start off with any initial questions? Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the second country of Kapilavastu in Naroda's part. Then Mahaprajapati Gotami took a new pair of clothes and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, she sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, this new pair of clothes has been spun by me, woven by me, especially for the Blessed One. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept it from me out of compassion." When this was said, the Blessed One told her, "Give it to the Sangha, Gotami. When you give it to the Sangha, the offering will be made both to me and to the Sangha." Okay, I guess we should go to the notes for people who are not familiar with who Mahaprajapati is and what the Buddha was trying to get her to do. So I think the commentary says on page note that Mahaprajapati obviously was the younger sister of Queen Mahamaya, which is the Buddha's mother, okay? And she was also the wife of King Suddhodana, which is the Buddha's father. So they were sisters. So after Queen Mahamaya's death, Mahaprajapati became the Buddha's foster mother. So the commentary says this present sutta takes place at an early point in the Buddha's ministry on one of his return visits to his native city. After King Suddhodana's death, Mahaprajapati pleaded with the Buddha to admit women into the Sangha, and her acceptance marked the beginning of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, the order of nun. Okay? So we keep that in mind. So you can see that because of her close relationship with the Buddha, raising him, that she is very attached to him. She wanted the cloth to go to the Buddha, and only him. And also being a second clan, they're famous for being very arrogant and proud. And she was, you know, second, you know, the woman, right? She's the queen. So she also, you know, she didn't want her cloth just to go to any old monks. She wanted for it to go to Buddha. But the Buddha, obviously understanding the law of karma, was encouraging her to kind of open her mind, make it more spacious, and kind of, don't, you know, with the intention for the gift to go to the Sangha. That way, as you know, you'll see from the later sutta reading, that when you support the Sangha, it brings great fruit because you are helping to perpetuate the teaching. You know, to help with the infrastructure, to keep, you know, the teaching going, not for just, you know, not just for monks in the present, but also for future monks, monks to come. Once the infrastructure is in place, it allows for people in the future to be ordained and to become enlightened. But if you offer gifts to one person, one that arahant, or even the Buddha passes away, then that's the end of that, in terms of the karma consequences. Okay? Okay, so continuing. A second and a third time, she said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, accept it from me out of compassion." And a second and a third time, the Blessed One told her, give it to the Sangha, go to me. When you give it to the Sangha, the offering will be made both to me and to the Sangha. Okay. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Ananda is really always very sympathetic to the Mahapachapati, and he's always the skillful ones, always kind of reminding the Buddha, you know, the role the Mahapachapati played in the Buddha's life. Okay, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept the new pair of claws from Mahapachapati, go to me. Mahapachapati, go to me, has been very helpful to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir. As his mother's sister, she was his nurse, his foster mother, the one who gave him milk. She suckled the Blessed One when his own mother died. The Blessed One, too, has been very helpful to Mahapachapati, go to me, Venerable Sir. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapachapati, go to me, has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapachapati, go to me, abstains from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, from wine and liquor and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence. Basically, this is the five precepts of a lay person. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapachapati, go to me, possesses perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and that she possesses the virtues loved by the noble ones. And this is a kind of a coded word in the sutta for saying that by this time, Mahapachapati was already a stream enterer, because she has perfect confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and she had the virtue loved by the noble ones. I mean, she perfected her five precepts. Okay? I think if you go to the notes, that's exactly what that would be saying. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapachapati, go to me, is free from doubt and about suffering, about the origin of suffering, about the cessation of suffering, and about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. The Blessed One has been very helpful to Mahapachapati, go to me. That's also another way of saying that she is indeed a stream enterer, because she's free from doubt about the Four Noble Truths. Okay? Any questions or comments? Okay. That is so, Ananda. That is so. When one person, owing to another, has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, I say that it's not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to him, rising up for him, according him reverential salutation and polite services, and providing robes, alms food, resting places, and medicinal requisites. Okay? And then he goes through the five precepts. When one person, owing to another, has come to abstain from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct and sensual pleasures, from false speech, and from wine, liquor, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to him, by providing robes, alms food, resting places, and medicinal requisites. Then he goes on to say about the same with the factors of stream entry, in terms of possess perfect confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, as well as to become free from doubt about suffering, about the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Okay? And then, now he takes this opportunity to go and to expound on the 14 kinds of personal offerings. Okay? Notes 1294. It says that the Buddha undertakes his teaching because the sutta began with a personal gift presented to him, and he wishes to make clear the comparative value of personal gifts and gifts offered to the Sangha. Like I was saying before, in terms of, you know, focusing the gift on one individual, or kind of opening our own mind and attention and encompassing the whole Sangha, you know, encompassing the whole dispensation, the whole infrastructure that keeps, you know, churning out monks and nuns year in and year out, allowing people to become in the yellow robes and then to be, you know, ordained and to become enlightened. Okay. There are 14 kinds of personal offerings, Ananda. One gives the gift to the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. This is the first kind of personal offerings. One gives a gift to a Pacheka Buddha. This is the second kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to an Arahant disciple of the Tathagata. This is the third kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of Arahatship. This is the fourth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to a non-returner. This is the fifth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of non-return. This is the sixth kind of personal offering. This is all personal offering. And it goes down from the once returner to a stream enterer, to the one, you know, enter upon the stream entry. That is the tenth kind of personal offering. Okay, after that, one gives the gift to one outside the dispensation, who is free from lust for sensual pleasure. This is the 11th kind of personal offering. And here the note explains that this is a person who is not a Buddhist, but still are able to, you know, is able to attain the jhanas and the kind of worldly knowledges, the usual psychic powers, divine eye, divine ear. But he's not enlightened and he's not within the Buddhist dispensation. But he's still worthy of offerings, you see. And then he goes down to, one gives a gift to a virtuous ordinary person. This is the 12th kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to an immoral ordinary person. This is the 13th kind of personal offering. And then one gives a gift to an animal. This is the 14th kind of personal offering. So it goes all the way from the enlightened, perfectly enlightened Buddha, all the way down to an animal. And these are the different types of personal offering. And with each of these kind of offering, there is a corresponding, you know, karmic reward for it. Okay, here Ananda, by giving a gift to an animal, the offering may be expected to be repaid 100-fold. By giving a gift to an immoral ordinary person, the offering may be expected to repay 1,000-fold. And it goes on, but I think the note, it doesn't mean like, you know, if you give like a piece of food or something, and then you get that by, you know, a certain number of fold back. I think it's, you know, in terms of karmic retribution, it's in our future lives, then your next 100 lifetime, you know, you get it back in one form or another. And with that, I think I'd like to tie it up with kind of other suttas regarding the karmic consequences of giving. This one is quite nice. It's in the anthology by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And it's the chapter on the way to fortune rebirth. And I think most people are kind of obviously already convinced of the, you know, the merit made by Dana already. It's interesting. This is what the Buddha has to say about it. He says, "O monks, if people knew, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they would not eat without having given. Nor would they allow the stain of stinginess to obsess them and to take root in their minds. Even if it were their last morsel, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared it, if there were someone to share it with. But monks, as people do not know, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they eat without having given. The stain of niggardliness obsesses them and takes root in their minds." Okay. So he says, even your last morsel, if you knew what great benefit it would, you would even give that away to share with somebody else. Okay. And then this is the chapters of the five in the Anguttara Nikaya, the benefits of almsgiving. Okay. So on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling in Savatthi in Cheta's Grove at Netapindika's monastery. At that time, Princess Sumana, with a following of 500 court ladies, in 500 chariots, came to see the Blessed One. Having arrived, she paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down to one side and said, "Lord, suppose there are two disciples of the Blessed One who are equal in faith, equal in virtue, and equal in wisdom. but one is the giver of alms and the other is not. Then these two, with the bodies break up after death, will be reborn in a happy state in a heavenly world. Having thus become devas, O Lord, would there be any distinction or difference between them? Okay, so this is two monks having the same level of faith, virtue, and wisdom, which are the basic the three kind of characters that people quantify where you are along the path. So same faith, same virtue, you know, equally in good in precepts, and the same wisdom. And the Buddha answers her, there would be Sumana, said the Blessed One. The one who has given alms, having become a deva, will surpass the non-giver in five ways. In divine lifespan, in divine beauty, in divine happiness, divine fame, and divine power. Okay? But if these two, Lord, passed away from there and returned to this world, here, would there still be some distinction or difference between them when they become human again? There would be, Sumana, said the Blessed One. The one who has given alms, having become a human being, will surpass the non-giver in five ways. In human lifespan, in human beauty, in human happiness, in human fame and power. Okay? But if these two, Lord, should go forth from home into homelessness. Would there still be any distinction or difference between them when they are monks? There would be, Sumana, said the Blessed One. The one who has given alms, having become monk, will surpass the non-giver in five ways. He is often asked to accept robes. It is rare that he is not asked. He is often asked to accept alms food. It is rare that he is not asked. He is also often asked to accept a dwelling and medicine. And further, his fellow monks are usually friendly towards him in deeds, words, and thoughts. It is rare that they are unfriendly. The gifts that bring him are mostly pleasing, and it's rare that they are not. It's interesting, living in the Sangha of monks, you can see that. The monks, basically, some of monks are well-behaved and kind of equal in this certain aspect. But certain monks, for some reason or other, do get a lot of things offered to them. A lot of people, you know, feel inspired, and they get lots and lots of offering. And on the external, it may seem that, you know, it's hard to tell. But then you reflect, maybe it is true. That it's just past karma. That certain monks do get lots and lots of offering without having to work very hard this lifetime. But the gift of alms only goes so far, okay? But Lord, if both attains arhanship, would there still be some distinction or difference between them? He wants to know. In that case, Sumana, I declare there will not be any difference between one liberation and the other. Okay, so she says, it's wonderful, Lord. It is marvelous. One has indeed good reason to give alms, good reason to do meritorious deeds. If they will be of help to one as a deva, of help as a human, and of help as a monk. Okay, but like I said, I've seen, looking many faces here, long-time supporters of the monastery and BSWA and the kind of nuns monastery. So I don't think you need to be convinced too much of this kind of Dhanabharami. That's why I'm not focusing too much on this. I know in kind of traditional Buddhist countries, it's very well conditioned that people give instinctively and find a lot of joy and happiness. But sometimes it does go over, a bit over the top. You probably don't know this, but sometimes, you know, the scene on the Bindabat table, a Bodhinyana, sometimes you're very sensitive. Some people want their dana at the beginning of the table only. That way monks get, you know, first thing they see, they usually take. And if sometimes you move it, you're big trouble. They yell at you. So you can see that, okay, it's good to give. But you have to remember the purpose of the giving. And it's in letting go. It's not another thing to attach to. You know, rites and ritual. You know, giving is letting go and allowing, you know, things to happen to have kind of watch the mind state. I know that everybody says, you know, okay, you want to make an offering. So with most of us, we want to kind of to maximize the merits that we're making. And, you know, obviously, you know, find out what the monks like or something. That way the food or the requisite would be used. So it's helpful. But also just check your state of mind. You know, it's like it is. It's towards letting go and generosity, and not to cling into, you know, the result. You make it really, you know, you put a lot of effort into making a nice dish. That's good. Whether the monks take it or not, you know, that's just the last 5 or 10%. The 90, 95% of the karma is made through the intention already. Buying the food, putting all the efforts in cooking it, and bringing it to the monastery. And not to let, you know, whether the food is being used or not, to ruin your whole day because it's not being touched or something. So just to make sure to keep the intention, you know, pure the whole time. Okay? But also, this is why I want to talk to some about dana. It's true, you know, especially in Thailand, many people have lots and lots of faith, but sometimes, you know, not so much wisdom. Because in these days, because we're living in, you know, the age of affluent, that many monasteries, you get offered, you know, personal computers, you get the cell phones, the video players, offering as personal gifts to monks. And, you know, you have to be careful, you have to do, you know, use some discernment. When we offer things to the monk, you know, we have to ask ourselves, is this going to help the monk in his practice of sense restraint, of living simplicity or not? Or is this actually going to be distraction to pull him out? Yeah, it's nice to offer nice things, but it doesn't have to be, you know, the latest iPod. It doesn't have to be you know, the latest gadget. Because, you know, basically, these are not necessary if you're a meditating monk. Obviously, there's always excuses, you know, do Dhamma work with computer and stuff like that. But it tends to get out of hand very quickly. So we have to, you know, as, you know, if you do make a gift, to be, you know, reflective, to use common sense. Yes. Sorry, the microphone system. Yeah.
So
but that is, it's intention, like, you know, since you're making the gift, I really like to say with the alms food, to the Sangha already. So that, you know, intention is made. So whether, you know, the most scallywag novice takes it, or the head monk who's completely enlightened takes it, I think, you know, that has very little to do with it. Because the intent, your karma has already been made by you know, making it to the Sangha already. Yes? That's right. But also later, there's a little verse that comes at the end of the suttas where the Buddha expounds on how the gift and the action is purified in terms of from the receiving end and the giving end. Yeah, sure. Any more questions or comments?
Does it depend on how the gift is given? Like if it was given to someone prepared something and gave it to another person to present to the Sangha, would the offering go to that person, and then that person who offered the second person and offered to the Sangha would receive the merit, but the person who actually produced or made it or cooked it or whatever would only receive the result from the person they passed it to?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's actually, there was one of the sutta when that came up, that this wealthy Brahmin, he you know, had some faith and he wanted to give an offering alms to the monk. But it was more of like, okay, you know, he ordered his servant to cook the food and then offer to the monk because he's very busy and very important. So he wasn't around. And interesting, the Buddha said that actually the servant got most of the good karma, because when he was, it brought, you know, he, in his own mind, when he was doing it, brought up a lot of joy and was very mindful that, yes, this is a great opportunity for me to be cooking and preparing food for the Sangha and giving it, even though it wasn't his kind of food. And whereas the monk got only the partial, because it was more just a thought thing, okay, you know, give some food to the Sangha. But in terms of the karma, you know, like, it's, yeah, it's one of these things, like, you get what you put into it. And his mental intention was just the fact that you tell someone to, you know, cook the food. Whereas the worker, his mental intention was, you know, along the whole day, or preparing from the food, bringing up joy and offering it into the hand of the Sangha. And you can see why sometimes we get into attachment to this, you know, rituals of offering to the hands. But I think, you know, it's said somewhere, I can't remember, but, you know, there are ways to offering food to the Sangha, and one of the best ways is to offer into the hands. That way you can see that if it's a personal contact, you're likely to have more contact with the monks or nuns, and then receive the teachings. Or just to come into the monastery, be inspired by the way of life. You know, also to remember that, yeah, there are, you know, other alternatives to the lay life of rushing and running around. That there are people who, you know, leaving all this behind. So that also kind of triggers your own monastic intention inside that may come to fruition someday in the future. So I think, you know, it's like this kind of karmic intention force behind it. It's how much you put into it. So back to your question of, you know, if you give the gift to that person intended for the Sangha, then okay, you still get the karmic consequences, the karmic, you know, merit. But if you give just intending to give it to a friend, and then he turns around and give it, then most, if it's the Sangha is given to him, then most of the karma would go to the last person who gave it, because that was his intention. Where your intention was to give it to a friend. Is that clear? Yeah. Okay. But like I said, only a real enlightened beings can see, you know, all the kind of interdependency of the karma. Buddha himself said, it's good to know the general thrust of karma. If you do good things will happen. But in terms of specific, you know, how much you get, how much share, and, you know, whether it's a Sangha and enlightened beings, you know, how much of this, you know, will come to fruition. Only the Buddha would know all that. And you think about karma too much, he said, that you makes you crazy. So just to know the rough thrust of it, that, okay, it's good karma you're making. But not try to work out in too much details what exactly happens and where. Okay. Yeah, because it reminds me of the story about, like, in the oldest of Ajahn Chah. And he, towards, you know, kind of the end of his life, before he was sick, he was getting quite famous. And was, you know, his reputation was growing far and wide. So he got a few invitations, you know, to go to Bangkok and teach. And as a result, he, you know, sometimes wasn't at the monastery. And it was still in the 70s, so Thailand was still a relatively poor country, especially in Ubon, kind of, you know, the poorer part of the country. So monks, even back then, didn't get too much food on the alms round. And, but because Ajahn Chah was there, they get enough to survive. But, you know, funny enough, when he goes away, the food dried up very quickly. And sometimes on the weekend, because he's very famous, you get these kind of visitors from Bangkok, they come down with, you know, truckloads of food, big pots of curry, nice durians, and then lots of nice fruits. And Western monk was saying that, you know, he saw this truck rocking up, and he's kind of feeling, oh, good, today's a good day, get a good feed out of this. And see them, you know, kind of unloading these kind of pots and pots of, you know, curries and nice veggies. And then, but before they got very far, he asked one of the, you know, monks around, where's Ajahn Chah? And it's, oh, he's in Bangkok. Within 5 seconds, they reload everything back to the truck, went somewhere else. So when Ajahn Chah heard about it, he really blasted them. Because you can see that in this, we're attached to the personality. You know, we want only arahant. If we want this arahant not around, we go down the street, offer to not arahant, and forget about the Sangha. And he was reminding them, he says, you know, I don't need your food. I finished my work already, you know. It's the other people, the novices and the monks here, who are still in training. You know, that's the one you should be supporting. Because that's where the future, you know, enlightened beings will come from. It's the whole kind of infrastructure that we always have to keep, you know, keep going. Even if there aren't, you know, we'll see later tutors, even if all the monks are not practicing, just, you know, kind of sitting around. The fact that you're keeping the infrastructure going, that will allow for future people, you know, opportunities for people to ordain, and then to still practice, and, you know, maybe one day become enlightened, even if at the current time you think, okay, not much is happening in this monastery, right? So it's good to keep that in mind. Okay. Okay, back to the sutta. Okay, so we're going on about the gift to an animal that we expected to pay 100-fold, and that goes up all the way to a gift to one outside the dispensation. This is on paragraph 6, towards the end of it. Who is free from lust for sensual pleasures, the offering may be expected to be repaid 100,000 times 100,000-fold. And then by giving a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of stream entry, the offering may be expected to repay incalculably, immeasurably. What then should be said about a gift to a stream enterer? It goes all the way up to a Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. And I think we go to the commentaries about what it says about incalculably. Incalculably. Say that three times. Incalculably. Incalculably. Yeah, okay. The commentary says that although the result of giving in each of these cases is incalculable, there's still an ascending gradation in their incalculability, similar to the ascending incalculability of the waters in the great river. Okay. Up to that of the waters in the ocean. And it says, perhaps, this immeasurable value consists in their becoming a supporting conditions for attainment of the path, fruit, and nibbana. Because I think, like I said, if you give to a stream enterer or anybody above that, it's the close association. And it's because of his deep wisdom that will, you know, help you along your path. You know, obviously, the more this person can penetrate into the truth, the more hopefully he can convey that to you and allow you to also teach in the highest Dhamma and allow that to kind of condition the way we look at life and put that kind of condition into our own mind and hopefully allow sometimes in the future that will come to fruition. So that's why these gifts are very important. Okay, then he goes to the seven kinds of offerings made to a Sangha. So the first is the individual offerings. And now he goes into more of a corporate body, the infrastructure, the system, what makes this whole thing happen. There are seven kinds of offerings made to the Sangha, Ananda. One gives a gift to a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, headed by the Buddha. This is the first kind of offering made to the Sangha. Okay. And note 1299. There is no gift equal in measure to this gift, the commentary says. And this is the kind of gift Mahapajapati would be giving by offering the pair of cloth to the Sangha. Because at that time, the Buddha was around, and that's why he was encouraging her to maximize her benefit, to give it to the Sangha when he was around, and you know, lots of arhats around, both sides, monks and nuns, okay, for her own benefit. And then it goes from a gift to a Sangha, both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, after the Tathagata has attained final nibbana. This is the second kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives gift to a Sangha of bhikkhus. This is the third kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift to a Sangha of bhikkhunis. This is the fourth kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift saying, appoint so many bhikkhus and bhikkhunis for me from the Sangha. This is the fifth kind of offering made to the Sangha. And then it goes down to appoint so many bhikkhunis for me from the Sangha. This is the seventh kind of offering made to the Sangha. Okay? But, and this is a more interesting bit, he goes on. In future times, Ananda, there will be members of the clan who are yellow-necked, immoral, of evil character. People will give gifts to these immoral persons for the sake of the Sangha. Even they, I say, an offering made to the Sangha is incalculable, immeasurable. And I say that in no way does a gift to a person individually ever have greater fruit than an offering made to the Sangha, right? So that's a pretty important statement, you know. A gift to a yellow-necked person, and which means, you know, the note says that in the future, when Buddhism is, you know, on the way out, and you wouldn't have any true monks, you just have monks, you know, they wouldn't even wear the yellow robe, they just wear a strip of cloth. Similar to the cloth that the priests wear, I guess. that's the only thing left of the monastic, kind of tradition. You know, they have wives and kids and they live like, you know, a lay life. But all they have left of the Buddhist tradition is just a yellow strip of cloth around their neck. But if a person gives to, you know, this person, but with the mind inclining towards saying, I'm giving this for the Sangha, still, that is greater merit than giving to a Buddha, enlightened being, or even a Buddha. Because as I was, the point I was making before, that because you are keeping this infrastructure, the dispensation alive, it allows, you know, for future people to get ordained. And also, because of the karmic training of the mind, and when even one person, we're still tied, because we're not enlightened, to personality, to attachment, to this thing we call my teacher, or the Buddha, the five khandhas. But when we give to a Sangha, then we, you know, kind of open our mind up, the spaciousness of saying, I'm not attached to an individual, but this, you know, this whole tradition, the whole teaching of the Sangha, the whole infrastructure. And then the merit you access are from all the, you know, monks of the past, and also future monks who may, because of your gift, and because keeping the infrastructure alive, you know, can come ordain and then finish their work. That's also, those merits will also accrue to anybody with the intention of giving gift to the Sangha of the Four Quarters. And that's why the highest gift, the Buddha said in another place, is giving lodgings to Sanghas of the Four Quarters. Because you're not reaping the merits of the present monks using it, but also any future monks who come and use the place will also, you know, be a merit for yourself as well. Questions or comments? Special notes. Yeah, like I was saying before, that in terms of, you know, people, obviously, if you go, you know, work very hard to make the money, and then to make the donation to the monastery, obviously, it's, you know, everybody wants to maximize your merit. And as I was saying, you know, the way to do that is obviously not to get too caught up in where your food is placed on the table, or whether it's taken by the monks or not, or whether Ajahn Brahm puts in his bowl and eats it. That's partly to do with it. But, you know, the way to maximize your merit is kind of be really aware and involved and bring up delight and joy in every stage of the process. Really bring up delight when you think, the thought occurs, oh, okay, today's Friday, I'm going to, you know, go to the monastery tomorrow. I'm going to buy some things and offer dana. So bring that up, bring happiness up when you go to the store, when you're looking for things to buy. You know, always be mindful the whole time. Okay, it's a great opportunity for me to still, you know, give things to the Sangha in this present age. And, you know, so while you're shopping, driving around, while you're cooking the food, always bring up the mindfulness. There's a great opportunity. You're making great heaps of karma, you know, to be given to the Sangha of monks and nuns who are practicing in the correct way. And then when you go to the monastery, also allow for plenty of time to get there and enjoy the peace and quiet, and not to, you know, wait till the last minute and rush around, and then, you know, our mind gets distracted. So always, you know, throughout the whole process of the dana, to be mindful, be peaceful, and recollect on what a huge, you know, karma you're creating. Huge positive karma we're creating every time you make a donation. Every time you bring food to the Sangha of monks or nuns. And then, you know, even when you're driving away home, always think, okay, this is great. I've done this great thing. And that way it brings up more happiness and joy. And then before you go to sleep, always bring up all the kind of, the great karma you made during the day. Any acts of kindness, not just to monks and nuns, but any acts of kindness to anybody during the day. Bring that up. That way it kind of reinforces the mind, always inclined towards, you know, generosity, always inclined towards kindness. And then the best thing is also when you meditate, I always try to do this all the time, first 5 minutes brings up any kind of delight and happiness of the, you know, and kind of recollect any good karma you made in the last couple of days or week. That way it helps, you know, makes the mind more light and brighter. And it's an aid to your meditation, your, you know, cultivation of the mind. Yes.
And did the Buddha, somewhere in another sutta, make a specific point of drawing attention to the fact that when you are generous and you give something to the monks or someone else, that you should not just do it and then move on to whatever else you're doing in your life, but that you, as you're saying, you should actually stop and take mental note of your action and the bodily and emotional reaction you have to the fact that you, of your generosity. I seem to recall some sutras ago that someone here was giving us a sutra class where the Buddha gave a specific direction that this is different from, say, not the Buddha talking about Christians, but the person who was giving the sutra class gave some, drew a distinction between the doing of good and the doing of good with mindlessness and the doing of good with mindfulness where you do this second, this intermediate thing where the real value in actually doing good and being generous is actually stopping afterwards, taking registration of the karmic effect of that on one's body and mind, and that to not do that is, can be largely miss out on the whole karmic effect of it. Do you recall a sutta where the Buddha is talking about this? Because someone, one of the nuns and monks, was talking about this. I think it was Ajahn Brahm, actually.
I think there's a few sutras where he does recommend, like, you know, the correct ways of giving. You know, give it faith and give it out of generosity. And you know, like I said, it's true. When, you know, as you know, karma is, you know, it's not intention. It's not in the mind. So the more we incline our mind towards this positive mind state, when we're mindful and we give things, then they'll have a, you can feel it. It'll have a greater consequence. Then it was just kind of perfunctorily give things because, you know, we've been doing it for so long and we just go to monastery because it's our Thursday, it's our day. And you can see that it has effect on the mind. If you, you know, you see that wealthy people cut a check. Maybe it's very wealthy, you know, it's a very large amount, $1 million or something. But for them, it's just, you know, writing a check. But whereas you see another person who's not so well up, but she puts a lot of effort in going, buying the thing that she could, cooking it, and really putting a lot of love and attention to what she's doing. Then, you know, the karmic retribution of this lady would be much greater than donating $1 million or $2 million to the monastery in terms of, you know, her own karma. You can see that. Yeah. But I don't remember specifically, yeah, which quote, but he does. I know that he says that. Obviously, when you do give, you know, give out of faith and be mindful and also to reflect on the actions.
Yes, reflecting is what I was referring to.
That's right, to reflect.
So would you consider that an essential component in this process?
It's a very large component. That's right. Yeah, to reflect anytime. That's right, but Rahula is more of a general thing, but before you do anything, in body, verbal, bodily, and thought, always reflect on before, during, and after. Yeah, that's true. And that's, you know, that's in line with what you're saying as well. Yeah. Okay, thanks for that. Any questions or comments? Okay, and then we go to about the four types of purifications of offering. Okay? There are four kinds of purification of offering. What for? There is the offering that is purified by the giver, not by the receiver. Okay, this is purified by the giver, not by the receiver. So, this is where the giver is a, you know, a person with lots of faith. And the receiver, let's say, not, you know, such a nice monk. He misbehaves. But still, his gift, because he gives out of faith, and because he believes, he has the right view in karma, the fruit will still ripen for him, because he's purified his own gift. Even if it's to an immoral person he's given to, if he gives out of faith, he gives him the right view, believing that karma will ripen the gift will still be purified by the giver. That's one way. The second one is that there's an offering that is purified by the receiver, not by the giver. And this is a case where you hear a lot of people said, you know, you have a thug or criminal, someone who robs a bank, but yet he comes and makes, you know, a donation to the monastery. Should we take that? Maybe the money is stained, or drug dealers, or whatever. The money is, you know, is stained already by this kind of criminal activity. But even then, the Buddha said, you know, if that person, even though his wealth is ill-gotten, but if the monk is virtuous, his gift is still purified by the fact that the monk is pure himself. And there's still good karma resulting from doing that. Right? Okay? So that's interesting. And then, the third one, there is an offering that is purified neither by the giver or by the receiver. In that case, you know, you have a criminal who gives to the wrong monk. Then that won't go very far. Because you can see, when you give to the right monk, a pure monk, an enlightened monk, his karmic potential is much higher. He's teaching people the true Dhamma. He's spreading, you know, the true Dhamma. And then so, you have a share in that. You know, investing in, let's say, you know, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mahabhu or something. It's like, you know, investing in, you know, giving things in to, you know, any kind of well-run company, you know, like a, you know, like a Bill Gates, like a Microsoft, because they're doing, you know, huge work. So whatever you have a part of that, because you feed him or looked after him, then that great karma he's making, you're having a part of that. So that's why, you know, you can see why there's some inclination towards finding out, you know, the attainments of different monk or the monks who have, you know, huge reputation, have a huge following. Because people want, they all want a piece of that, that good karma. Right. And then there's an offering that is purified both by the giver and by the receiver. Okay, he explains it though. And what is the offering that is purified by the giver and not by the receiver? Here, the giver is virtuous, of good character, and the receiver is immoral, of evil character. I was saying before, like I said, you know, if we're talking to a lay person given to a monk, the lay person is virtuous and of good character, and the monk is not so well behaved, of evil character. But the offering is still purified by the giver, not by the receiver. And then the second example is, what is offering? The offering that is purified by the receiver and not by the giver. Here, the giver is immoral, of evil character, a bank robber, or a drug dealer. But the receiver is virtuous, of good character. Thus, the offering is purified by the receiver, by the virtuous monk, and not by the giver. And the third one I was saying toward is you have, you know, a thief who's given to a monk who's not practicing, not keeping sila. Then the offering is not purified by the giver or the receiver. And what is the offering that is purified both by the giver and the receiver? Here the giver is virtuous of good character, and the receiver is virtuous of good character. Thus the offering is purified both by the giver and by the receiver. These are the four kinds of purification of offering. Okay. And let me go to the last paragraph. That is what the Blessed One said. When the Sublime One has said that, the teacher said further, when a virtuous person to an immoral person gives, with a trusting heart, a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, the giver's virtue purifies the offering. When an immoral person to a virtuous person gives, with untrusting heart, a gift unrighteously obtained, nor places faith that the fruit of action is great, still the receiver's virtue purifies the offering. But when an immoral person to an immoral person gives, with untrusting heart and a gift unrighteously obtained, nor places faith that the fruit of action is great, then neither's virtue purifies the offering. But when a virtuous person to a virtuous person gives, with trusting heart and a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, that gift, I say, will come to full fruition. And then, this is the interesting last paragraph. When a passionless person to a passionless person gives, with trusting heart, a gift righteously obtained, placed in faith that the fruit of action is great. That gift, I say, is the best of worldly gifts.
Okay.
And I think in the note 13 or 4, it says that the last verse refers to the gift of one arhant gives to another. See, although the arhant believes in the fruit of karma, but because he was without desire and lust for existence, his own act of giving is not productive of any fruits. It is mere functional action that leaves no traces behind. Because a lot of our karma is for future birth. And we have two beings who've ended all that. That, you know, the act of giving won't go any further because, you know, he can't. You know, he's, you know, even though they still have right view, you know, purified, the action is completely purified without any kind of craving. There is no future karma because they've ended it. It's completely gone. But it's still the best of worldly gifts because it's still of this world. In terms of a few more comments, are there any questions or comments? Yes, you know, like I said, giving even to an animal is fruitful. So if giving to another religion, you know, we say we don't have right view, but also right views, there are degrees. You know, there are degrees of right view. They might not believe in terms of, you know, karma specifically as we call it, but some people still believe that if you do good things happen, or there's a just God who meets out these kind of rewards. You know, call it karma, call it God or whatever. So it's still roughly right view. But as long as they're virtuous, it still purifies the gift. That's right. Yes, you.
Venerable, this is just slightly off, but it's in paragraph 5, talking about a person who is outside, free from lust and sensual pleasures, but outside the dispensation.
Uh-huh.
So how do you become inside the dispensation, and what does that mean? What does
I think meaning by taking the three refuges and keeping the five precepts. So the three refuges, I mean, believe in Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Outside dispensation, meaning people of other religion, but still, you know, practice, you know, some sort of, I think in the notes it says some sort of jhana. And because, you know, this is more controversial, Ajahn Brahms, you know his view is that only Buddhists discovered jhanas. The Buddha discovered jhana, but also in other places, it says that in the Middle Ages, you know, Catholic nuns and monks who could also achieve states of jhana by letting go to, you know, the divine being they call God. So it helps the letting go. So apparently people outside of the Buddhist dispensation can also achieve, you know, absorption states, deep meditation, the jhanas, and the psychic powers that goes with it. So I think that's what he was talking about.
The other five precepts?
Yeah. Those are the five precepts that, you know, kind of, most Buddhists, you know, keep.
So is that what determines,
the person in dispensation, yes, right. The three refuges and five precepts, those are the minimum qualification.
But what happens if they're keeping them and they don't realize that they are keeping them?
So that's what I mean. I think to get into jhanas, you have to have a certain level of you know, sila. And even so, there is, I mean, if they have right view, it's better, but if they don't, it's still, you know, a good, because the purity of their mind, you know, there's still, you know, a lot of merit to be had. Yeah. Let's see, any other comments? Yeah, just to emphasize, like I said, with them, you know, on the dana, that dana is just, you know, a part of the path that we have to go on to develop sila and panya. And that there's a few quotes here that the Buddha says in relation to this dana that is, you know, goes outside of this sutta. But in the chapter of the fives in the Anguttara Nikaya, okay, then the householder Anattapindika, which is the Buddha's famous lay supporter, very wealthy merchant, okay, accompanied by 500 lay followers, approached the Blessed One. The Blessed One then said to them, householders, You attend upon the Sangha of monks with robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites for use in time of sickness, but you should not remain satisfied merely with this. Rather, householders, you should train yourself thus. How can we enter and dwell from time to time in the rapture of seclusion? Thus, you should train yourselves. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Lord. It is marvelous, Lord. How well spoken." That statement of the Blessed One, "Wherever, Lord, a noble disciple enters and dwells in the rapture of seclusion, on that occasion, these five things come to him. Whatever pain and grief there is connected with sensual desire does not exist on that occasion. Whatever pleasure and joy there is connected with the sensual desire does not exist on that occasion. Whatever pain and grief there is connected with the unwholesome does not exist on that occasion. Whatever pleasure and joy there is connected with the unwholesome does not exist on that occasion. And whatever pain and grief there is connected with the wholesome does not exist on that occasion. So whenever a noble disciple enters and dwells in the rapture of seclusion, on that occasion, these five things come to him." So it's good, good, Sariputta. So basically what it means is the rapture of seclusion is samadhi, the first two jhanas, the first and second jhanas. So he's encouraging his disciples that, just don't stop at dana, because that's where you get traditional Buddhists, quite happy to give, and give instinctively and happily. But then you don't see much more development beyond the dana. And if you see that it is the start of the path, and it's very important, but there's so much more to do. Because, with the dana, we're opening our mind, making it positive, brightening it. But then we have to use that energy to go inward, to really calm the mind down. And then, with the samadhi, use that also wisdom to liberate ourselves. And with the dana, always inclined towards, the spiritual happiness. And that's why the jhanas help. You're saying this. You kind of secluded away from any worldly happiness. Secluded away from any unwholesome state. So once you brighten your mind with the dana, then use it to move forward into, bhavana, developing the mind in meditation. And also, that's not an end in itself, to move that forward to develop the panya that liberates. Okay? So that's one where he says, okay, not to stop short with just dana. Another one. And here, dana, you've given people and beings material thing. But sila is also a gift to other beings around us in terms of freedom from fear, freedom from, anxiety. You know the person will steal from you. You don't have to worry. You can leave them in your house. If everybody follows the five precepts, we wouldn't have so much anxiety around people breaking in, people lying to you, taking your things. And when people say some things, if you're always truthful and stick to that, then there's that trust behind. You're giving people fear from anxiety. Because what you say is always true. They don't have to worry and start to, proliferate over what does he mean or she means when she says this. Is this, as it appears. So it's also a gift. Here it says, okay. "There are further amongst these five gifts, pristine, of long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated, and never before adulterated, that are not being adulterated, that will not be adulterated, not despised by wise ascetics and Brahmins. And what are these five gifts? Here amongst, a noble disciple gives up the destruction of life and abstains from it. By abstaining from the destruction of life, the noble disciples give to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. By giving to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression, he himself will enjoy immeasurable freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. This is the first of those great gifts of the fourth stream of merit." See, so sila is also along the line of giving, just a different kind of giving. Okay? And he goes on to say the same with the gives up with taking what is not given, abstains from sexual misconduct, abstains from false speech, and from wines, liquor, and intoxicants. Okay, so basically in conclusion, yeah, the merits of giving to the Sangha of monks and nuns is much higher than that even to the most exalted monks or nuns or even to the Buddha. So always kind of, like I said, you know, to keep that in mind when we are inclining towards giving the Sangha of monks or nuns anything. And second is to exercise some discernment in terms of the type of gift, appropriateness of whether it's good. You know, it's going to help the monk or nuns to live a simple life. It's going to help the monks or nuns or the Sangha to incline towards simplicity, contentment with little. Or it's going to complicate things more. You know, I mean, computers are nice, but I think we have about 5 computers already in the monastery. And yeah, in the future things are going that way, but you know, it's always, to have a trade-off that, we're trying to, simplify our life. A computer always, huge gift of Mara. It promises so much, like sensuality promises so much, makes your life so easy. So many things you can do. But I've been around computers enough to know that it usually takes about 5 to 10 times more time than you think. And like, oh, it's going to be 15 minutes. Then 5 hours later, you're still doing it. So, that's something with, as a monk, we have to keep, I'm just saying this for myself, to be very wary of. And then, and also, like I said, don't stop at just, you know, dana. There is sila, that you always purify the 5 precepts, and we always do more. And then, you know, also, on certain days, inclines when you go to the monastery or on opposita days, to keep the 8 precepts. You know, because when you start to meditate, you know that, you know, sense restraint is there to help the meditation. It's not just rites and ritual. It's not an act of asceticism to, you know, show off to others, but it's an act of going inward, an act of allowing the energy of the mind to build up when we're not going outside, when we're not talking. You know, it just helps the practice of meditation and helps, you know, with the clarity of insight that we can derive from the samadhi. Okay. Okay. And finally, the to caution regarding the gains, honors, and fame. Okay. Oh, yeah, okay, this is one, the insight. Remember, the name of the game here is just not dana, not sila, but it's panya, it's bhavana. It's only through wisdom, insight, that we can cut through the delusion. It's only through insight that we really free ourselves from the suffering, see the 4 noble truths, and be finished with all this. Okay, so this one is in the Buddhist word again, and insight surpasses all. Buddha again is talking to Anatta Pindika. In the past householder, there was a Brahma named Velama. He gave such great alms offer as this: 84,000 bowls of gold filled with silver, 84,000 bowls of silver filled with gold, 84,000 bronze bowls filled with bullions, 84,000 elephants, chariots, cows, maidens, and couches, many millions of fine cloths, and indescribable amounts of food, drink, oil, and bedding. As great as was the alms offerings of the Brahman Velama gave, it would be even more fruitful if one would feed a single person possessed of right view. Right view here is a coded word for stream enterer, okay? So as great as the Brahman Velama's alms offering was, And though one would feed 100 person possess the right view, it would be more fruitful if one could feed a single once returner. And he goes on to once returner, non-returner, an arahant, the Pacheka Buddha, and the perfect enlightened Buddha. Okay, so, you know, saying how great it is just to feed these different individuals. But he doesn't stop there. It would be more fruitful if one were to feed the Sangha monks headed by the Buddha and build a monastery for the sake of the Sangha, the four quarters. So the Sangha, the four quarters, is on top of everything. Because, like I said before, it's infrastructure to create, you know, allow monks of the past to practice, monks in the present to practice, and monks in the future to come. Okay? As long as you keep the infrastructure alive, then Buddhism is still alive. Sometimes the teaching may be corrupt, but it will allow for someone in the future to always go back to the teaching, always practice the right way, the direct way, and realize for themselves, as long as the infrastructure is here. Well, think about it. There's no monastery, then all that is not possible. Okay? But, so the highest gift, in terms of gift, is building a monastery for the sake of the Sangha, of the four quarters. But he goes on to say, it would be even more fruitful with a trusting mind, one would go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and would undertake the five precepts, abstaining from the destruction of life, you know, of taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from the use of intoxicants. And, as great as all this might be, it would be even more fruitful if one would develop a mind of loving kindness, even for the time it takes to pull a cow's udder. So he says, all about the development of the mind. Dana is just the start of it. And it's, you know, once we brighten the mind, you know, shouldn't stop there. Continue to use it in terms of, you know, to bring up thoughts of loving kindness. And then the final one. But I think, you know, I asked Ajahn Brahmali this back then. And he said, it's just not like, okay, I like everybody. May all beings be well. I think it has more to be deep in that. I think it's kind of, this kind of loving kindness that come from deep samadhi, jhana state or something. That would have much more effect than the five precepts and the refuges and any gift you can make to the Sangha. And as great as all this might be, this is the summation, the peak of all this. It would be more fruitful still if one would develop the perception of impermanence just for the time it takes to snap one's finger. That is the highest. So it's always about panya, about mind development, Buddhism, right? So all that, whatever we're giving, always inclining towards that. So, you know, the coarse material gifts, and then the mental gift. And then, you know, bring that inwards. Use the power, the energy, the happiness from giving to always purify our own minds. And then you cut through the delusion once and for all.